Through high winds and hail, dry years and wet, and through the pressures of development and corporate interests, Atina and Martin Diffley pursued a dream of making organic farming work, and they succeeded. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The Diffleys owned and operated one of the first certified organic farms in the Midwest, the Gardens of Egan, originally located in Egan, Minnesota. Atina Diffley has written about her farm and her life in the new book, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. Today, I'll talk with her about her experiences, how growing organic food and educating her customers became her life's mission, and what she wants the world to know about organic farming. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. From 1973 to 2007, Atina and Martin Diffley owned and operated the Gardens of Egan, one of the first certified organic farms in the Midwest. When they started out, they didn't really know if it would be possible to turn an organic farm into the kind of operation that could sustain a family. And they certainly had plenty of people telling them that it wasn't possible, but they persevered and turned the Gardens of Egan into a model for organic vegetable farmers everywhere. Atina Diffley has written about her farm and her life in the new book, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works, and she is here with me today. Hello, Atina.
Hello, Charity. It's really a treat to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. And let's start with where you started. When you grew up, you loved to spend time in the garden.
My connection with nature and God was profound. It really was a spiritual relationship for me to be in the garden, connected with the food, connected with the soil. It was, when I look back at my very beginning and my youngest memories, they're all in the garden with nature.
When you were growing up and spending time in the garden, was that something that you did with your mother? Did you learn to take care of plants from someone who knew what they were doing?
It was a major part of our family because we produced most of our fresh food or wildcrafted it. So it was, you know, many people talk about the kitchen as the place that their family comes together at the table. And for my family, it really was the garden. And it was those spring rituals of the first time we rototilled and following my father, who steered the tiller and stepping into his big footprints behind him, that really brought into my heart this relationship that we have with nature for our very basic substance, food, and how that relationship affects all the rest of the life on that land. So it really went right from the start to me.
When you were growing up, though, what did you think that you could be or would be with your life?
That's a great question because every child gets asked that. And I had a very flippant response, which was I was going to be a farmer or a bum. And my family didn't like the bum response too much, but I thought they both got to be outside and they both got to be dirty and they both got to be their own boss. But later as a farmer, I found out otherwise on the boss part. But it really wasn't until I left my parents' home and I was a young woman living in Milwaukee, then I had to buy food for the first time in my life from the grocery store, and I found I couldn't eat it. It just had no vitality to it, no life to it. It had been through this intense system that had really beaten the life out of it. And that was when I knew I really had to farm because I needed to grow food for myself. And I just really wanted to find a way to produce food that really had vitality to nourish other people. So that was when I decided I wanted to be a farmer.
When you were young and you left your parents' home, you didn't really feel empowered to have a career or to be what you wanted to be at that point. Why do you think that was?
You know, I think that was a lot about society, and I'm very fascinated by familial patterns and generational patterns that get handed between family lines. So I came from a family where the women were strong farm women, and they had opinions and they could do things, but they were also very subordinate. And I grew up kind of with victim thinking and some learned helplessness about my own place in the world as a woman. And I found that so fascinating to explore in my book, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, because I could see how throughout the course of my life, various experiences I had help me see the areas where I had learned helplessness and to give it up. Because I think that's really crucial for all of us to just really get at the areas where we give up our personal power and our ability to act in the world in a productive and effective way and to not believe in ourselves. So that I got to this point where I could say to myself, this is what's really important to me. I need to act on this. I'm the one that can see this needs to change so I can get engaged with it. But that was a process that I developed over my lifetime and wasn't necessarily raised with.
Well, and you don't dwell on not being raised with that very much in the book, but there is a very telling moment when you worked very hard to graduate from high school early, and then you were kind of going crazy, stir crazy at home while everybody else was at school trying to figure out what to do with your life. You told your dad you wanted to go study music at the community college, and he said you'd never last.
Yeah, and that was in my family. Women went to college to find a man. That was a family belief, and that women belonged in the home. And it's actually, I brought that up again later in the book, a conversation I had with my father about 10 years ago when I had been farming actively for 20 years, running a big business, doing all the sales and marketing. And he told me that women didn't need to work outside the home. And I said, well, Dad, I work outside the home. And he said, no, you don't. You're on the farm. And I said, well, I'm not really in the house baking cookies and, you know, cleaning and being with the kids. In fact, I have a cleaning lady. And in his mind, it was okay that I worked on the farm. That wasn't leaving home. So it was just a different set of standards that my family had. And I really had to get to a point where I could listen to my own beliefs and my own standards instead of just following the pre-described standards that come familially.
You tried to break away when you were 17 years old and you ran away from home. You went to Milwaukee and you got a job. You met someone in Milwaukee that really changed your thinking, and her name was Anita. Tell me about her.
Yeah, because I was Anita's caretaker. She was in her 90s, and there I was 17, just, you know, with the young freshness and idealism and excitement of going out in the world and becoming me, myself, and who I was, and exploring all that. And so to have Anita as a role model and mentor in my life at that point was so crucial, because she was very different than the female role models I had been raised with. She was a suffragette. She was born in the 1880s. She'd seen a very different world. She'd never married, and she'd traveled the world in the early 1900s, so very unusual for a woman. And she had her own opinions, and she wasn't afraid to stand up for what she believed. So she gave me a very different role model and concept of who I could be as a woman in my life. And that lesson, it took time to, you know, you take these lessons in life, and then it takes time to incorporate them. I actually was within a few years of being with Anita in an abusive marriage. And I look back now, and it's very interesting to me that it took me 5 years to actually step out of playing a victim role. When you're in an abusive relationship, there's two roles. There's the abuser and the victim. And I played the victim role. And it went right back to my childhood of learned helplessness, of thinking that I didn't really have a right of my own to stand up and say, this isn't working for me. And I would have conversations where I said, you know, I think we should break up and this isn't healthy. And he would say, no, we can't break up. We have a good marriage. And I didn't know how to say, no, we don't. And this isn't working for me. And I'm going to make the change. So Anita really modeled that for me, but it took 5 or 6 years to actually incorporate it and then to come forward with it as part of my self. So that is something I really try to show in the book, turn here, to show this change in me as a character from someone who was very subordinate to someone who could think for herself.
That first marriage, while obviously personally, emotionally destructive, I get the impression that part of what drew you to Eddie was the fact that he was involved in the organic food movement.
Yeah.
And so it opened up a world to you that you didn't even know was there.
It's absolutely true. And, you know, today, looking back 30 years, I have so much gratitude to him. I have no hard feelings or anything. We were young, two young people working with what we had at that time in our lives and not doing a very good job of it, you know? And later on, we had a really wonderful relationship as a farmer and produce buyer. He was the produce manager in one of my best accounts. So we had a business relationship as well as a co-parenting relationship. And I love that I was able to put that into this story to show how two people who may have dysfunction and problems can grow and have other kinds of relationships that can be healthy. And to help people kind of move on and see that that can be real.
You and Eddie traveled around the country. You first met in Milwaukee, and then you were migrant farm workers in Florida for a while. So you honed your tangerine picking skills, which would serve you very well later on, picking apples and doing hard farm work. But you wound up back in Minnesota, and you had a child with Eddie, Eliza. And while you were pregnant, you met Martin Diffley. Tell me about that first meeting.
Well, the first time I met Martin, I actually didn't know I met him. And so he was running his roadside stand. He was farming on his family's fourth-generation family farm in Eagan, Minnesota. And that first meeting, I really met the land because I had gone out there with Eddie and a produce buyer from a warehouse. And when we arrived, Martin was running the roadside stand, and I didn't get introduced to him. And so I thought he was just the clerk because he looked far too clean and gentlemanly-like for my image of a farmer named Martin.
Right.
I was
way too young and handsome to be a farmer, right?
So I thought, oh, I'm not interested in talking to him. I wanted to meet the farmer. So I went for a walk, and I met that piece of land and fell in love instantly. It was a highly diverse piece of land. It was still an intact ecosystem, rolling hills. The fields were nestled small in the valley, surrounded by hawthorns, flowers, plums, berries, oaks, sumac. It was extremely diverse. And the fields were small, and they were diverse too, the crops in them. And there were crops that nobody was growing then. At that point in time, that was 1982. So the organic movement really hadn't taken off yet. And I was just in love. And when I came back from my walk, there was a cider press behind the shed. And I spotted that. And I had been picking apples and was really in love with apples. And I went, cider press. I'm going to come out and ask if I can use that cider press. So that was the first time I met Martin when I came back. And I called him up and said, can I use that press? And I came out and used it.
We'll find out what happened when you came out and used the press in just a moment. We have to take a short break. I'm talking with Atina Diffley. She is the author of the new book, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. It's a memoir of her life on an organic farm in Minnesota, one of the first certified organic farms in the Midwest. It was called Gardens of Eagan, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Atina Diffley will be the keynote speaker at Field to Family's Harvest Dinner in Iowa City on Sunday. You can find out more information about that event and about Atina on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Atina Diffley. She is the author of the new book, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. It's a memoir of her life on the farm, Gardens of Eagan, one of the first certified organic farms in the Midwest. She owned and operated that farm with her husband, Martin, through 2007. She's now a consultant. She has an organization called Organic Farming Works, along with her husband, Martin. And she's going to be in Iowa City on Sunday. She'll be the keynote speaker at Field to Family's Harvest Dinner in Iowa City. And Atina, just before the break, we were talking about the first time you really met your now husband, Martin Diffley. You wanted to borrow his cider press and got permission to come out and use the cider press. What was your first encounter like?
It was really pretty symbolic of our future in the sense that one of our first conversations, we got into a little bit of an argument. I had showed up with about 20 bushels of apples that I'd picked on the way out, just driving along, spotting a tree, and then stopping and asking. And he suggested that I might have stolen them. And I had to let him know that I hadn't. And that was just sort of funny when I look back now that we've always been able to be who we are with each other and say what we think. And we certainly did that the first time we met. But I pressed the cider with his press. And Then I went over and had a conversation with him after I was finished, and what he said to me was that he was a gardener, not a farmer. And I was at this point in my life where I really wanted to be an organic farmer, and I was going through what young beginning farmers go through now, same challenges, access to land, access to capital. I was having a hard time imagining how I was going to break those barriers. So here was this man with 25 acres in vegetable production and a wholesale business and a roadside stand saying to me, I'm not a farmer, I'm a gardener. And his definition of that was that a gardener stays in relationship with the land and the community and the customers and the plants. And that a farmer gets so caught up in the image and production that they have a hard time maintaining that relationship. So that was his definition in 1982. And it made sense to me later that that relationship was the fundamental thing that I, as a farmer, had to always remember in my decision-making. It had to always come first.
Your marriage lasted for another year or so after that, and you finally found the strength to leave this abusive relationship. And you also decided that you had to just get away, and you went to spend 4 months in Ireland with your daughter, really living off the land and just being by yourself, just the two of you, and finding yourself. But before you left, although you hadn't had a romantic relationship with Martin prior to your divorce, he made it clear that he really wanted to see a great deal more of you when you came back.
Yeah, he did. And it was actually one of the reasons that I wanted to go away is I wanted to get healthy and really find the patterns I had that weren't healthy. And I could see that I had played victim and that I was an equal partner in this unhealthy relationship. So before I started another relationship, I wanted to get really clear and dig that all up and get back to where I felt good about who I was. And that was really a hard thing to do, going to Ireland by myself. I was living on the top of a mountain. I really didn't see any other people except for my daughter, who was 1 year old, and so she was, you know, the responsibility of a young child for me. It was the lonely experience of my life. I was just so in my own space with no one else to talk to, but it was one of the best things I could have done, is to just basically spend 4 months of soul searching and get healthier.
So when you returned, Martin was waiting for you. He said he would be patient and wait for you. And when you got back, I mean, you described the business that Martin had been running. And as you mentioned, he called himself a gardener. And in some ways, it seems like he hadn't fully committed to the idea that this was his business.
He hadn't, because the land he was farming was the fourth generation urban edge land that had been in his family since the 1850s. The region had once been the market basket for the Twin Cities. It had been full of market gardeners with roadside stands and direct deliveries. And for the last 25 years, so most of his life, they had known that there was an end in sight, that development would come and the land could not be kept as agricultural. And at that point in time, the city of Egan had not kept any land zoned for agriculture. So for him, every year was the last. And he didn't have a farming partner, so I think he had a very hard time seeing a future.
And
he was just in that present.
He was also a musician. He also cut hair. He was a barber. Mm-hmm. So he had all of these other things going. And for you, when you had the idea of working with him on this land, that definition of gardener or farmer was a real sticking point for you. Why was that so hard to overcome?
I think we were just caught up in semantics. But I visualized a farmer as producing a lot of food and feeding a lot of people. That was my definition of that word. So, yeah, we would have just little healthy arguments about it. But, you know, when I joined his business, it changed everything for him because he'd never had a partner. And so all of a sudden, we're very different personalities and we have very different strengths. So we were such a perfect match as far as a business in that the areas where he is skilled and patient, I am not, and the areas where I am skilled and patient, he is not. So I was really able to take over the parts of the business that weren't getting the attention they needed to be a really successful business. And that partnership, we, both of us, neither of us could have done that business without the other. We really had a true partnership. And that was so gratifying to have that level of relationship and partnership with my love and marriage partner, also being my business partner and my parenting partner. It was so integrated. We weren't just a farm family. We really were a family farming together. And our children were directly engaged with the work that we did. They were in the fields with us. They helped us run our roadside stand. They knew what we did, why we did it, what our values were. They knew who they were and where they came from. And in retrospect, looking back, that still is, for me, one of my most gratifying parts of my life, is those few years that we farmed up there on that family land.
Well, and you say few years because, as you mentioned, none of this land was zoned agricultural. The development was coming. You and Martin didn't own the land that you were farming on. That was land in Martin's family, but it wasn't something that you had ownership rights over. So the end was coming, and we'll talk about that end in a moment and the new beginning. But in a way, it struck me that you were successful in part because of where you were, in spite of the fact that there was all this development pressure on you. Being in Eagan, Minnesota certainly was a very special place to be, so close to the Twin Cities. What made that the perfect place to be an organic farmer?
It had the right soil, it had location, it had access to the market and the customer. In hindsight, it was very short-sighted to not recognize that the Eagan was full of these market gardeners. It was an intact food system that was supplying much of the food for the Twin Cities. So that wasn't recognized as value. The thinking at that point in time was that the land was worth so much for development that it couldn't be used for agriculture and that agriculture didn't have that level of contribution. I think that looks different to us now as a society. We're starting to recognize how crucial food security is, food close to the urban areas. We need to come a long way further on this right now. We need to get to where we're actually having cities drawing food plans and saying, here's our resources. These are the areas of high fertility soils. This is where the people are. Let's draw a food system, a regional food system, that really defines where the majority of our food is going to come from. And that is so within the realm of what we can accomplish in actually a short period of time. We have the resources. We have the land close to most cities. But it has to change the way we look at these resources and land. And we have to look very far out. We have to think about feeding people in 100 years, in 200 years, and say, what do we need to do right now so that that will be possible, instead of just assuming that we can ship food long distances?
Well, and in Minneapolis, it struck me that the organic food movement really took off in that city. It maybe in other big cities around the nation at the same time, but in Minneapolis, it sounds like you couldn't go more than a block without running into a food co-op.
I don't think any city has what Minneapolis has as far as the food co-op movement and the support they've given to their farmers. We had unprecedented support from our market, and that enabled us to really build our business. I think it was far more powerful than a grant of money could have been, because we knew exactly what our market was. We could make budget and business decisions, build our infrastructure based on that market, and it was like a solid wall behind us. We didn't need anything free. We needed to do the best job that we could possibly do as farmers, and we needed to know that that market was reliable and that we could grow for it. That was what we needed, and that's what we got, and that was why we were successful.
I'm talking to Atina Diffley. She's the author of the new book, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. And it's a memoir about her life and her farm, Gardens of Eagan. And you foreshadowed the end there. The development did come to your farm in Eagan, Minnesota, and it came fast and it came furious. What did you do to survive?
You know, that was the most important lesson of my life. Because when they started the development, it was a 4-year project. So they allowed us to continue renting the land that wasn't yet developed. And it meant that we were immediately adjacent to land that had had all life removed from it. The bulldozers came in and they removed every tree, every bush, every blade of grass. The birds, the animals left. They remove the living topsoil. And as organic farmers, that's how we function our systems. We manage our pests and disease through the diversity of our ecosystems and the habitat for beneficial insects. We manage our fertility by growing soil-building crops and rotating our cash crops. And all of a sudden, that whole intact ecosystem was simply gone. It was a void. And we had crops literally immediately adjacent to land that had no life. And we experienced an ecological collapse. We had terrible pest problems. The species that normally ate our pests, the frogs, the birds, the beneficial insects, they were gone. They weren't there to control our pests. When it would rain, there was no life to take in the water, and so the subsoil would run off into our fields and cause erosion and bury crops. So that was absolutely profound to see. We learned this in school, how we're utterly dependent upon nature. But it's intellectual, you know. We read about the soil purifying our water and the trees purifying our air and the microorganisms that control disease. And we could go on all long time about these ecosystem services. I didn't know the phrase ecosystem service or biological diversity habitat in 1989 when I witnessed this. But I felt it at my gut level because I saw this void and that we couldn't survive without nature.
And you also saw your children reacting to seeing this land that they were so close to, this land that they loved, destroyed.
Yeah.
How did they react?
You know, that went right back to my own childhood and my own spiritual relationship with nature. My children had that same experience growing up in those fields where the farm was their sanctuary. It was where they came in touch with the divine and witnessed the life cycle. And they were very young. My son was 3 and my daughter was 7 when it started. And what they witnessed was a violent rape of nature and of the land they loved. And they reacted very differently. My son became very violent and aggressive and really expressed his rage. And he got through it because he expressed it and came out on the other side. Whereas my daughter withdrew and stopped engaging with us as a farm family, stopped being at the roadside stand. Basically, she wanted to stay in the house and clean, which is, in retrospect, I can see a classic rape victim symptom. So I see her experience there as the same as a rape victim and the symptoms she then had. It took her much longer to recover. And when we did get to our new farm, she didn't reattach to the land. I think she was really afraid to love again for a very long time. It took her a long time to heal. Whereas our son, he reattached right away when we got to the new land.
The new land was not particularly lovable in some ways when you first found it. Tell me about this acreage that you found and what it looked like when you bought it.
Well, it was 100 acres, and we could look at the soil types and see how much potential they had. They were deep, rich prairie soils, but they had been chemically farmed for quite a while, and the soils had really lost their organic matter and microbial life in the soil. So the soil was very compacted, and when it would rain, the water really couldn't soak in. It would either pool in puddles or run off and cause erosion downstream for our neighbors. But we knew how to deal with that as organic farmers because a large part of our organic process for an organic fertility system is to bring organic matter into the soil and to feed that microbial life. I like to talk about farm soil as a wild animal held in captivity because living in that soil are more undomesticated species than can be found above ground on the entire planet. One tablespoon of soil has over 50 million microbes, miles of fungi, 10,000 protozoas and nematodes. And, you know, this is our soil life, and it needs simple needs, just like we as humans do, of food and air and water and shelter. So in an agricultural system, it's prevented from caring for itself because nature takes care of this microbial life with the plants that grow on and the decomposition process. So by taking land and making it bare, exposed to the elements, we basically are embezzling its ability to command its own wellness when we open up land. So as organic farmers, we're constantly recognizing that the very act of farming it is degenerative to the wellness of that soil. And so our agricultural practices include processes to regenerate and to bring that life back to the soil and to take care of that life. And that life really affects the hydrology of the soil, which is what I started this with, explaining to you how the water couldn't soak in and it would run off. And by bringing that life to the soil, it created aggregates and water channels and organic matter that could soak water in like a sponge. So within 2 or 3 years, we started seeing major changes in our soil structures and its response to rainfall and its ability to hold rain. You know, a really fascinating statistic is that for every 1% of organic matter in the soil, it can hold 16,500 gallons of water. So this is hugely important as we move forward with climate change, because there's a lot more erratic rainfall and longer droughts. And I know in Iowa, you're experiencing a severe drought right now. So if we take care of our soils and improve the organic matter levels, it can really help create resiliency to these dry periods.
Atina Diffley is the author of the new book, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment, and you're welcome to join us. The number to call is 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Atina Diffley. She's the author of the new book, Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. And for many decades, she and her husband, Martin, owned and operated one of the first certified organic farms in the Midwest, the Gardens of Egan. She'll be in Iowa this weekend. She'll be in Iowa City. She'll be the keynote speaker at Field to Families Harvest Dinner at the Hotel Vetro in Iowa City on Sunday. And Atina, just before the break, we were talking about the new land that you found, and you had to do a great deal to rehabilitate the land that you would be farming. You also had to tear down all the buildings, including the house on the land, because they had been abandoned for some time. You had to wait 3 years before you could even farm on that land, right?
Yes, we're a certified organic farm, and the National Organic Program requirements are that 36 months of no prohibited substances are used before it can be certified.
So why did you have to wait before farming at all? You could have farmed. You could have grown food on that land, and it just wouldn't have been certified organic. Why wait all that time?
Yeah, we could have farmed on it. And many organic farmers during the transition period do take crops off and sell them into the conventional market. For us, that process of soil building is so crucial to the soil health. And while you're in the middle of it, it may seem expensive because you have all the expenses related to owning land and caring for the land and planting soil building crops on it. But when we look long term, and the results that we receive by getting our soil in really good condition before we take our cash crop off it, then it seems like the least expensive fertility that there is in the world, because it provides our needs, our fertility and our irrigation, simply by getting that land in really good condition. So even later, after we have that land in condition, we always include a soil building process at some point in the year for almost every crop. And that's one of the wonderful things about growing vegetables, is they don't always take up the entire season. So a crop like broccoli, for example, may not be planted until late July and then be harvested in October. So we have that whole spring period to actually be growing soil-building crops before we take that cash crop and put it in the field. So for us, that care of the soil is a win-win situation. We receive far more in dollars and cents from that cash crop's improved health and yield and quality when we've taken it out of production and given it that time to heal.
I want to talk about your relationship with your customers. I mean, you mentioned the relationship that you had selling wholesale to the co-ops in Minneapolis and St. Paul, but you also had this farm stand, and you had an opportunity to see your customers face-to-face, and you also used that opportunity to educate your customers. How did you think about that relationship?
You know, this is really crucial, because we really saw our relationship, an individual sale wasn't the one that mattered, but we looked really long-term. So today's sale wasn't what counted, but the sales it would lead to and the relationships it would lead to. And we really educated our customers through story and through showing a vision and hope, what was possible. So we told them stories from our experiences in the field, which they loved, and it really educated them on how organic farming systems work. I'll give you an example of one. I was in the greenhouse one day, and I noticed aphids on the pepper plants, and I had never actually had a pest problem in my greenhouse before. It was very unusual to have that experience. Our plants generally were healthy, and we just didn't have these problems occurring. So that in and of itself was unusual. So I looked at it the way organic farmers look at these things, and I asked myself, I wonder if I had too much nitrogen in the potting soil, because nitrogen will cause the plants to grow faster, and you get a thinner cell wall, and it makes it more possible for pest insects to penetrate, and so it's attractive to the aphids. So that was my first thought. And then my second thought was, morning, I had been in the vetch field checking to see if the vetch was ready to incorporate. The hairy vetch was our soybean crop. It can set up to 160 pounds of nitrogen per acre. And when I was in that field, I had noticed that it was absolutely full of lady beetle larvae. And we had made the decision not to incorporate that field for another 2 or 3 days to give those larvae enough time to be a little more mature and actually leave the field and go out into the other areas. So I put two and two together very quickly. Ladybug larvae love aphids. So I just went back to the greenhouse and loaded those plants on a hay wagon, Meals on Wheels. I don't have to bring the lady beetles to the aphids. I can take the aphids to the lady beetles. And I pulled those hay wagons out into the hairy vetch field and left them for the day. And when I came back, there were no aphids left. And those plants were covered with those lady beetles, and I put them back in the greenhouse, and the problem was solved. Simple. I didn't have to use a toxic pesticide. I solved the problem. I worked with the ecosystem that I had in place, and I had enough of an ecosystem in place that I was able to reach to that for that support that I needed as a farmer. So telling those stories was wonderful for our customers, because then when they came to buy the pepper or whatever the food was that was related to the story I told, they knew clearly in their mind how it had been produced differently, and they were making a decision that that was the kind of agriculture they wanted to have a relationship with.
You also spend a lot of your time educating the young people who come to work for you. Obviously, you need to have employees on the farm to help you with all of this labor, but it's also an opportunity to educate them. And it struck me, some of the descriptions of some of these young people, that you get a lot of young idealists who come to you who don't necessarily have a real understanding of what it's like to farm.
That's why that opportunity for them to have an experience on a farm is so valuable. I was young and idealistic once too. I love idealistic people. I think it's very sad when people don't dream and think outside the box, which is what they're doing when they're in those ideals, but they're not necessarily realistic. When we get those experiences based on the real life, then we can take that passion and excitement that comes with the idealism and the dream, and we can then create real working, functioning systems.
Do you find that a lot of them get discouraged? Because what you do is hard work.
Some people get discouraged. Farming is very hard work. It's not for everyone. And others come, you know, when people come to work for us, and we haven't said this, but in 2008, we sold the Gardens Vegan name, and is now owned and operated by the Wedge Co-op in the Twin Cities. So if we slip into present tense here, I want our listeners to know that I am not actively farming at this point in time, and the Wedge Co-op has now manages the Gardens Vegan. But the really important thing for those learners is that they're getting in there and they're learning it, and it changes their life profoundly, whether they go into farming or not. When people apply for a job with us, we ask them why they want to work for us. Many times they say they don't really know if they want to farm. They just want to have the experience. And those people end up farming as often as the people who come to us and say they want to farm. So where they come from doesn't necessarily dictate where they end up, but that experience really changes them whether they go into farming or not, because they see how those relationships work and how crucial the way we treat our agricultural land is. You know, it's really important to realize that almost 40% of the non-frozen surface of the earth is in agricultural systems. So we talk about saving wildlife and protecting our resources, and the largest impact we have on the environment is through agriculture. So it is really, really crucial that we start transforming our agricultural systems to be ecologically sound, and that that become a main criteria as we make our agricultural decisions.
Early in your career as a farmer, you lost a fight to development, but much later in your career as a farmer, you had to fight a new kind of development. You got word that there was a planned pipeline that was going to cross your property and take out a number of your fields. What did you have to do to keep that from happening?
You know, the first thing I had to do was empower myself, because I was frightened. And I'm really embarrassed to say the first thing I did when I received the letters from the pipeline company telling us that we were in this pipeline corridor, which is I ran down to the machine shop where Martin, my husband, was working, and I told him that he needed to call the pipeline company, and then I went into a half an hour long spiel about what he should tell them. And he just looked at me and said, "They put these things where you want. They want. You have all the answers. You call them." And I realized then I was going right back to my learned helplessness of thinking that here was this problem and somebody else had to fix it. I didn't want to be the person to fix it. So that was really a moment of empowerment for me, because I really got that, you know, maybe the system's working for the pipeline company. They're not going to change it, but it's not working for me. And if I don't like it, I'm going to have to be the one that changes it. So that was the point where I got that, and I went online and tried to get some education for myself, because it was all so new and overwhelming. Their application is like 10 three-ring binders thick in language that I don't really understand. It's not really in layman's terms. But I pulled down three of the documents that were online, and the first one was a criteria for route selection. And when I read it, I knew right away that if they went to court, putting it across our farm would violate many of those criteria. And then there was an agricultural impact mitigation plan. And I started reading that, and I came across that the Mincan pipeline will not knowingly allow more than 12 inches of topsoil erosion. And to say that to an organic farmer who took care of her soil by building the crop, the fertility of that soil and that life in the soil, and to think that they could not knowingly allow 12 inches of topsoil erosion. I mean, I only have 12 inches. There's nothing left. I really got then that it was my responsibility to be the human voice for that soil, that in our courts of law, nature doesn't have a right of its own. So if we want to protect nature, we have to show a loss to humans. So Martin and I intervened in the legal proceeding and hired an attorney, Paula Maccabee. And what Paula and I discussed was that we needed to show for the legal record that an organic farm was a valuable natural resource that should be protected as such. So we brought in expert witnesses and we showed our farming systems and how they provided benefits to society as far as keeping the water clean and affecting the air, those sorts of benefits that went beyond the food produced. So it wasn't only the people eating that were receiving benefits from our land, but it went so much broader than that. And we set the goal of moving the pipeline to the road, so it'd be in the road right away and not crossing our fields or someone else's fields, and to write an organic mitigation plan that specifically addressed protecting the soils and certification on organic farms. So we brought in expert witnesses, we showed organic research, we brought out our organic system plan. Every organic farm has an organic system plan, which is the details about how that particular farm will be operated in accordance with the National Organic Program standards. And that was a very valuable document. I encourage all organic farms to be certified, because when you have that organic system plan, it is a federally registered, inspected, and certified document that's very credible in a court of law. And it showed that our practices that we were stating we used were not just hearsay, but that they were really credible. The other component we had that was really important in this legal proceeding was we went to our customers, and my attorney, Paula, educated me on the difference between public rhetoric and informed citizen input. And that public rhetoric is basically noise and attracts media and it makes a lot of excitement, but it's not necessarily effective in a legal proceeding. Whereas informed citizen input was letters from our customers, from scientists, from doctors, talking about organic systems and why they mattered and how Gardens Vegan in particular was a crucial part of their lives and their food system. And over 4,500 people wrote letters for one organic farm saying, this farm is not fungible. It is not replaceable for another of like kind. Please protect it. Which was just an unprecedented amount of support for a small little organic farm to receive. And it made a huge difference because it really showed how crucial that land use was. This whole process was so fascinating because I realized that I was actually educating the Department of Agriculture and the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce. They really didn't know that much about organic farming systems. The Department of Agriculture came out to the farm. We showed them our systems. We showed them how we were creating our fertility with plants and the energy of the sun. And they got right behind our organic mitigation plan, and they negotiated with the pipeline company, and they testified in the legal proceeding in favor of writing an organic mitigation plan. And so that passed. We were successful in all of our goals. The pipeline went along the road, and this organic mitigation plan was accepted by the Public Utilities Commission. It's now standard practice in Minnesota when public utilities cross an organic farm to take these special protections to protect them.
So you saved your own farm, but you also made it possible for other farms to protect themselves.
Yeah, it gave them one tool. It doesn't mean that they're not going to necessarily be crossed. There has been farms, when possible, public utilities do seem to be avoiding organic farms now since this. And if they do cross them, it gives that farmer a tool that they can use to minimize the damage. And it's created a recognition for the organic farmer's system plan. Every organic farm has its own unique system plan written by that farmer. So it's created an understanding of that system plan and brought it into those processes of proper mitigation so that if the farmer is doing it in their mitigation plan, in their system plan, how they're caring for their soil, then that utility is expected to do that similar behavior. And it's helped keep, it's also being applied during maintenance and care if there's already a utility easement across a farm, that if it's an organic farm, then they're not going in and just spraying an herbicide to control the weeds, et cetera. So
Atina,
it's helping those farmers that way.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but you've been involved in the organic food movement since its infancy, really, in this country. What do you think about the movement today? How do you feel when you look around you?
I talk to people all in every walk of life, whether it's a clerk at the gas station or in a grocery store, and I ask them if they could afford organic food, would they buy it? And they say, yes, I want organic food. Americans want organic food. And so it's really crucial that we get policy changes that make it an even playing field for customers, that they have access to organic food. I'm so excited about what's happening because we now know organic farming systems work. It's the future. As we move into a world that has less access to fossil fuels, it's going to be really crucial that we have organic farming systems to produce our food.
Atina.
So it's a really exciting time.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Atina Diffley is the author of Turn Here, Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. And she will be in Iowa City on Sunday as the keynote speaker at Field to Family's Harvest Dinner. You can find out more on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.